A podcast of the cinema.
How are you, husband?
I am
named Alonzo Duralde.
I'm great, thank you. How are you, spouse named Dave White?
I'm fine. I'm all right. Mm-hmm. I'm annoyed. I'm looking at this picture.
Who's annoying you now?
Food 52.
Ooh.
The website that I have a love and hate relationship with.
I was going to say, I'm surprised to hear you talking smack about your side piece, Food 52.
I'm looking at this picture of someone perfectly laminating dough.
Get bent.
And I'm like, every time I see a picture of someone like doing it with precision,
brushing,
there's no mess around them. Like there's like, you don't see like a flour everywhere. It's just sort of like, here I am folding the dough. Then I fold, I make a turn, I roll it out again, I fold it again. Guess what? It's not like that. I mean, it is if you're fancy, if you know what you're doing, I guess. I mean, they only probably hire professional.
Your croissant dough is built on a tissue of lies.
Dough laminators at Food 52. I don't understand. That's probably what they do.
Would you prefer, like, if it were, you know, Naomi Watts in the Book of Henry with a big, like, splotch of cake dough across her forehead and, like,
must,
you know.
Must I choose between one extreme and the other?
That's all the internet is.
You're right. I know that is you're right.
Hot failure or glistening success.
What do you do for a living? What are your qualifications for doing this podcast?
We
named each other and then we just went off to talk about laminating dough.
Well, you did actually. Bunch of stuff. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap. I'm co-host of the Who Shot You podcast over on Maximum Fun. And co-host of the What the Flick podcast in Exile. We're no longer a YouTube show at the moment, but we are still reviewing the week's new movies over at ChristyLemire.com while we regroup and figure out what's next. And yourself?
You should change the name.
I suspect we might.
Change the name.
We'll see what happens.
I'm coming up with so many great ideas.
Yes.
For all the name changes that you should do.
Yes.
And you're all gonna agree that one of them is brilliant.
Okay.
And accept it.
Well, this morning I came up with just shortening it to what?
I appreciate that as a name change.
I suspect it's been taken as a podcast name.
I don't think anyone else is on your crew.
Perhaps not.
Is gonna be into it. I don't even know what I do. I'm a half-assed dough laminator.
Well, but that's just a part of what you are.
I am a film critic.
Yes.
Sometimes I write for The Wrap.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Like, other than that, I'm the business end of this.
You work for Linoleum Knife Inc.
Inc. Yes. I mean, we are an Inc.
Yes.
I don't think people know. We incorporated like 8 years ago,
maybe even longer.
No, it was 2010.
So the same year that we started the podcast?
Yeah.
Crazy.
I mean, coincidentally.
Yeah.
Like, starting the podcast was not a result of incorporating it,
right.
Nor did we incorporate because of the podcast. We incorporated for tax purposes.
Because we're freelancers.
5 years into doing the podcast when we started Patreon.
Right.
More on that later.
Mm-hmm.
Being incorporated really helped.
Yep.
Because suddenly it became a business.
Yep.
This hobby became a business. And now it's kind of my full-time home gig.
Yeah.
Tending.
We have a shop. It's a podcast.
We really do.
But it's a shop.
Okay. So there are six films to talk about.
Yes.
We have, how many have we both seen? We both saw Little Women.
Yes.
We both saw Love, Gilda.
Yep.
We both saw The Sisters Brothers.
Correct.
You saw Night School because we both decided not to see Night School because the reviews were so terrible And people were saying, no, don't bother. But then I learned that you have to talk about Night School on your other podcast.
Yes.
Who Shot You on the Maximum Fun Network. So you had to go see Night School.
Yes.
This morning.
Yes, I did.
And you chose to go see Smallfoot because you reviewed it?
No, I reviewed it for the
Wrap. For the
Wrap.
Yeah. I honestly, I was waiting for you to taste test Smallfoot for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't like the taste of feet in general. Ha ha.
No offense to those of you who do.
One of the pleasures of being married to you and being your business partner as well as your life partner is sometimes you have no choice.
I got to take that bullet.
But to go see a film. And I will sit at home and happily work on other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you come home and say, yeah, yeah, you need to see this, then I'll go out. I'll either get to a secondary press screening or I'll buy a ticket on opening morning. But if you come home and say, and then that's corroborated by other people whose opinions I respect,
mm-hmm.
then I'm not in. Yeah.
How nice for you.
Old Man in the Sea. I don't know what I'm going to do about Old Man in the Sea. Oh, Old Man and the Gun. Old Man and the Gun. Old Man in the Sea is a book.
Yes. Also a movie.
Yeah, also a movie.
Not a good one.
Old Man and the Gun. I don't have any interest. I'm not interested.
Shall we start there?
Let's start at the one that I'm not interested
in. Sure. Okay, so it's David Lowery's new film, and you tend to like David Lowery's
stuff. Yeah, in general,
stuff.
I do. In general,
you liked Ghost Story, you liked Pete's Dragon.
I like Pete's Dragon. Quite a bit I liked Pete's Dragon.
I think you liked Ain't Them Body Saints more than I did, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
So this is a true story. This guy named Forrest Tucker, not the one who was on F Troop.
Right.
Who was an older gentleman who robbed banks and apparently did so in a very courtly sort of way. Like he would show it, he would pass a note, he would maybe show the handle of the gun,
right.
Get his money, and the cops would come later and the teller would always say something like, well, he was very much a gentleman.
Right.
This is happening in Texas.
Did he terrify people with the gun?
No. No, he was always super chill.
But
he had the gun.
And he showed them the gun.
He showed them the gun.
And that instills fear in people.
I suppose so. But he would, like, if they start crying or whatever, he'll, like, kind of say, no, it's okay, relax, just, you know, very calming. It's weird. It's kind of like Clooney and Out of Sight, maybe, you know, that sort of, like, dapper robber type. Anyway.
Fine. All right, go on.
So it's Robert Redford purportedly in his last performance. Saying this is his last film. I've heard that one before from a lot of people. And
right.
They very rarely stick to it, but we'll see. It is aggressively trying to be like a 70s movie. Like down to the fonts,
right.
The way it's edited. Even like there are parts at the end where they sort of give you the title cards telling you what happened afterwards.
Right.
Where it's just like a solid blue screen with kind of small type in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And it has that same kind of fuzziness that you would see in a 70s movie.
Right.
That kind of blew me away, especially for a film that was shot, you know, digitally.
Right.
You know, it is aggressively low key. Like it is not, there's no stakes, there's no tension. Casey Affleck is pursuing him, but you know, at his own pace.
Mm-hmm.
Redford strikes up a romance with a widow played by Sissy Spacek, and it doesn't race anywhere, but they clearly enjoy each other's company and, you know, start spending time together.
All right.
Their scenes together are lovely. Their scenes together are the reason to see the movie, for the most part.
Okay.
I mean, the rest of it is fine. There's nothing wrong with this movie. It's just like, you know, I was on Scott Mance's movie talk show on Collider this week, and I was saying that it's kind of like the dude Ocean's 8 in how sort of breezy it is.
Didn't we already have a dude's Ocean's 8?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. But you know, it's very kind of like, yeah, I guess there's some crimes happening here, but whatever. But you know, they'll send it to us. Yeah, they'll send us a screener. You can watch on a screener, not miss much.
This is now. Tomorrow is October 1st, and I'm already thinking about what do I have to see versus what are they just going to send to the house?
Right. Yes, it's the last quarter. It's also, you know, time to start thinking about Christmas.
Calm down.
I said thinking. I'm not going to subject you to as I'll subject you as little as possible.
But I was actually thinking, is this something I could watch on a screener while I address Christmas cards?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, you'll miss that fuzziness, you know, but whatever.
It'll be fine. Can watch a film from the 70s if I want to see that fuzziness.
I know. It's just kind of cool how they recreate it. But yeah, Redford is fine.
Okay. You've got me now leaning toward it.
Uh-huh.
Primarily because I do love... I do love the idea of banks being robbed.
Well, sure.
Just in general.
But it doesn't have that same... It doesn't have the political undercurrent of something like Hell or High Water.
I see.
It's just like... this is a guy who, like, you find out his entire life has been, like, minor crimes, escaped from a gajillion different, you know, prisons and, you know, youth institutions or whatever. So, just, like, that's just who he is.
If I could get away with it, guaranteed, I would absolutely participate in a heist, not a bank robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you show the gun and that terrifies people.
Right.
And that makes you a bad person. But a heist, there's no violence involved. There's only your wits and stealing the money from a bank.
They don't even know it's happening until it's over.
Should honestly, in this world, be happening every day. Someone should be heisting a bank every day.
Yeah, but the thing is, the
just as a kind of protest.
But the whole system is, if we can veer off into this, the whole system is set up that they're never going to really lose anything. Insurance companies or the government or somebody is going to give them back.
But
everything.
they should keep getting heisted.
Well, sure.
If you're not a dummy, please go out and plan a really smart heist.
B of A is never going to suffer. I mean, look, if all those banks manage to survive...
How do we also make them suffer? In addition to getting money, how do we also make them suffer?
Well, you know, socialism. send these guys to jail for the 2008 housing crisis.
But right.
That didn't happen.
No, that did not. All right. So,
Yeah, maybe. It's fine. It's nice. Is nice, the old man in the gun.
Well, let's just keep going with what you've seen and what I have.
Okay, fine.
Talk, what's the Smallfoot?
Okay.
Who is the Smallfoot? Zendaya is Michi.
Zendaya is Michi. Let's never forget that. We are the Smallfoot.
Right.
Human beings are the Smallfoot to the Yeti, who live high, high, high up in the Himalayas and, you know, live in an enclosed community that is led by the Stonekeeper, who is voiced by Common, who's in, like, everything this week.
Yes. He's in a film next week.
And he's in All About Nina this week, which neither of us saw. But
I didn't see All About Nina.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so, you know, it's a prescribed... Like, everybody has their job, and everybody has their task, and all the tasks revolve around, like, waking up the snail that goes across the sky that provides the sun, you know, the light. Creating these ice balls to cool down the mammoths who hold up the planet. You know?
All right.
But it turns out, no, all of this stuff is designed to hide the Yetis from humanity.
Okay.
And the main Yeti, who is voiced by Channing Tatum, wants to step into his father's job as the guy who goes headfirst into the gong that wakes up the snail every day. But as he's trying it out, he misses the gong entirely, flies over the wall of the city, sees a plane crash, and sees a guy come out of it and realizes, oh my gosh, the mythical Smallfoot.
The
legend of the Smallfoot is real.
Right.
So he goes back to the village, and the Stonekeeper basically tells him, no, you didn't see what you think you saw. No. But it turns out there's a...
Do they have TV shows where people are hunting for Smallfoot and can't find it?
No. But...
Because we have those...
Put a pin in that.
Reverse.
Put a pin in that. We're getting there.
And they're great.
But Channing Tatum finds out there is a small cadre of other Yeti who suspect that Smallfoot... Foots might be real, uh-huh. and they are led by Zendaya as Michi. And then they decide to lower Channing Tatum down the mountain to into the world of the Smallfoots, and he finds them just as a failing animal show host voiced by James Corden wants to fake a Yeti sighting so the video will go viral, but then, of course, he actually encounters a real one, right. and then they go up to the village of the Yeti, and then... There's a couple of weird things going on here. So this movie is produced and has story credits by Requa and Fakara, okay. who are the guys behind yes. Bad Santa and yep. I Love You, Philip Morris. Yep. They also do a lot of animated stuff.
We like them.
Out. Yes.
Yep.
I didn't realize they have like all these kid credits in addition to their grown-up stuff.
Are you currently talking so fast that you're getting too much air in your gullet?
I might be. I'll slow down. So it's a thing that happens.
Because I can see you... almost gasping and gulping over there, and I'm thinking, is he going to die?
I promise not to.
Please don't die. I made a lovely lasagna, spinach lasagna,
yes, yes.
for dinner, and you need to
be around for that. I promise.
To eat it, also to chaperone me through the second half of my life.
So, this movie, on the one hand, is really like. Daring for a kid's movie as far as the messaging.
Uh-huh.
Because the message of the movie is doubt everything you are told,
yes.
including religion.
Yes.
Governments will tell you things that are patently false to control you, but then tell you that it's for your own good.
Yes.
Tribalism benefits nobody but the people in charge. Like,
right.
Like I was agape and agog yes at what this movie was saying. I was like, holy crap.
Well, then should I see it?
On the other hand,
okay,
it's pretty basic.
All right,
the animation's not that great. It is like the many of the Disney live action versions of the animated films. It doesn't quite commit to being a musical, but it's not a musical.
How much singing is there?
There's like three or four numbers. But the only good one is the one that Zendaya as Michi sings.
Well, that makes sense because she was the only good song in the
Greatest Showman.
The Greatest Snowman.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is the Greatest Abominable Snowman. She,
Mr. Police.
I gave you all the clues.
I gave you all the clues.
And a song or two. She has a song called Wonderful Life that's quite nice. But the movie opens with basically... as Christy Lemire pointed out, everything is awesome. It's basically the Channing Tatum has a song where he explains where he lives and what everybody does and how awesome it is and how great, you know, their life is and how nobody asks questions because that's too complicated.
Right.
Which that aspect is annoying enough. What made me crazy was that it's one of those songs that has whistling and ukuleles. Like, every commercial for healthy breakfast products right now.
What's the ukulele version of Over the Rainbow?
Oh, yeah, that guy. I know, he's dead, it's sad. But
oh, is he dead?
I believe he is, yes.
Oh, I didn't know about
but
that.
But I could happily never hear that song.
I don't even know
again.
Who it was that sang that.
I don't remember.
Guy.
It was a hit.
I honestly thought it was Bobby McFerrin.
No. But yeah, whistling and ukuleles, it's got to go. the movie is just, it's not visually interesting. The characters don't really pop. So there's some great subversive writing going on as far as the big picture, but individual lines of dialogue and characters aren't all that interesting.
They'll send it to us.
Yeah, it's super meh. And I mean, like...
I'll watch the screener.
Think of it this way. It's from Warner Animation.
I'll watch the screener on the television and the old man with the gun on the laptop.
Okay.
At the same time
there
while I'm
go.
Addressing
while
Christmas
While you're
cards.
Addressing Christmas cards.
Yes.
It's from Warner Animation, who a couple years ago did Storks, which I thought was great.
Yes.
And like, you know, a movie that was impossible to market, and I wish more people had seen it. But this is just... forgettable.
All right, then. Let's continue.
Oh, God, you're wearing me out here.
You have exactly 30 seconds to talk about Night School. And the reason you're going to go that short on it is because everyone listening to us needs to go listen to Alonzo
on Who Shot,
on Who Shot You, because they don't do their podcast the same way we do ours. No. Y'all don't talk about everything that you've seen that week.
No, we pick one movie.
You talk about a movie.
Yeah.
And you go in on that movie. Also, April is fantastic. Also, Ricky is fantastic. And y'all are going to sit there and talk about Night School for too long. So today, you're going to talk about it for too short.
I went into Night School with very, very low expectations because the reviews have been bad.
Well, I was seeing Sisters Brothers.
Right. Which we'll get to in a moment. The reviews have been bad, so I thought, okay, fine. There's going to be like a few funny Kevin Hart, Tiffany Haddish moments. I like Kevin Hart. I like Tiffany Haddish. Like, sure, that'll be worth getting through the rest of the stuff.
Yes.
I didn't laugh one time. I mean, granted, I was in a mostly empty theater, which probably didn't help, but it didn't get in the way.
That never gets in the way of me.
Didn't get in the way of the lady behind me, who was chuckling up a storm the whole time.
More than Smallfoot and more than Old Man and the Gun. In spite of all the bad press this film has gotten this week, and in spite of what you say, I still love Tiffany Haddish enough that I would want to watch this.
She does not really get a lot of opportunities to pop. And it's not that she has to play the same thing every time, but they just don't really give her anything all that funny to do.
Right, because it's Kevin Hart's time to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, but he doesn't either, though. That's the thing. I mean,
well, here's the thing
six
about him.
Six credited screenwriters. And it's so choppy. It's an hour and 50 minutes long.
Whoa.
And it still feels like they're rushing through the plot. Like, it still feels like there's big chunks missing and, like, character advancements that happen off screen.
Kevin Hart has reached the point in his life, in his career, where all he... we're going to get to this when we talk about Love, Gilda. He shows up and all people want from him is Kevin Hart. They don't want a character. They don't want anything but him yelling.
And he has managed to do that in different and interesting ways. I mean, like the last Jumanji movie, Central Intelligence. Yeah. Like, I feel like he's at least finding variations on a theme.
Yes.
This one is so underdeveloped that I never got a hold on who the heck this guy was supposed to be. Worst of all... this movie completely wastes Megalyn Echikunwoke.
I don't know who that is.
He was a playboy or operator type.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
She doesn't get
I wonder, sometimes I think about that movie, Damsels in Distress from Whit Stillman, and I think about the women in that film, besides the ones who aren't Greta Gerwig.
Right.
Where are they?
Well, she works, and she's in this movie, but she is... she's a straight man the entire time.
Oh.
And she's hilarious, and they gave her nothing funny to
say.
Yeah, so that's... Now that you mention it, though, let's look them up. Okay, one of them was Anna Lee Tipton.
Okay, she does things.
She does things.
Yeah.
She was in Warm Bodies.
Right.
She was in that movie All Nighter. She was in Golden Eggers.
Okay, you don't have to list all the credits.
Okay, fine. Carrie McLemore... was in the Whit Stillman Amazon pilot, The Cosmopolitans.
I see.
And that's been it.
So okay. Well, that's a bummer.
Yeah. Anyway, don't bother. Now but do listen to the Who Shot You this week.
You said that they were trying to be kind of like Night School, though. I mean, Summer School.
Well, now you've spoiled my DVD.
I haven't spoiled anything. If you hadn't said it, I wouldn't have.
No, well, I mean,
you brought this up.
It's that thing of the like motley group of students that come together and have to learn a thing.
Right.
It's handled much better in Summer School, which is my DVD pick.
Why don't you just talk about your DVD pick this week right now?
Summer School, directed by Carl Reiner, starring Mark Harmon and Kirstie Alley, about a laid back
1986 or 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Laid back teacher gets stuck teaching a summer class. And you know, there's the nerdy kid, and there's the, like, the dudes who are obsessed with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and there's the guy who is moonlighting as a male stripper, and there's, you know, it's a room full of types. And basically, he has to, like, guide them through their, you know, the big exam at the end of the summer.
Right.
It's low-key and a bit whatever, but it's charming and it's funny, and it's
a lot of shade tipping.
And it is a million times better than Night School.
Okay, Love, Gilda.
Yes.
That is a documentary about Gilda Radner.
Mm-hmm. Premiered this year at Tribeca.
It was, yeah. And now it is in a real limited theatrical
release. It's in some theaters, but it is streaming at home. You can watch it at your house. Yeah.
Here's what I learned about Gilda Radner in this film. She grew up rich. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
She had an eating disorder while she was on Saturday Night Live. I didn't know that.
I think I knew that.
She dated all the guys. And not just all the guys on SNL. She dated all the guys. They even say she had a lot of boyfriends. And she not only dated Bill Murray, she dated Brian Doyle Murray.
Yeah.
She
one to the other.
One boyfriend, one brother was the boyfriend, and then the other brother was the boyfriend. And most of all, what I learned is that she was always funny, even when she wasn't in front of an audience.
Right.
And I know that there are people in the world, funny people in the world, who are famous, who the minute the camera's off them, the minute off stage, they are cold as cement blocks of ice.
Right.
That there's no such thing as a cement block of ice.
But I knew what you. But it was I just invented it. Yes, simile.
I can think of one in particular whose name I'm not going to mention, but we have mutual friends.
Yes.
And dude isn't nice, and is very chilling.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, we also know comedians who are lovely people.
Yes.
Sometimes they are not. She seemed lovely, and she seemed to have a lot of really close friends.
Yes. What's lovely about this film is that you really get a very sort of full picture of her childhood, her teenage years, what brought her into Saturday Night Live, how she navigated the all-male world of places like Second City.
And the National Lampoon's Lemmings.
Yeah. And how she sort of charmed everyone, all these dudes, mm-hmm. into wanting her to be in the group.
Right.
With them. Belushi called her on the phone and said, we need a girl. Will you be the girl?
Right.
She said, sure, I'll be the girl.
There's all these audio recordings of her, which is great to have.
Yeah.
And she talks about how, I think it was the National Lampoon Radio Hour, how they'd be in the room and everybody'd be throwing out ideas, and she would have ideas, but she couldn't spit them out as fast as the boys. So what she did was like, oh, let me type everything. And then that way she could force them to slow down and she could insert her own stuff.
Right.
You know, so
very,
yeah.
Very clever. She took the obstacles and went around the outside.
Yeah.
And got what she needed done her way.
It feels a little slight at times.
Near the end, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Near the end, I think they were trying not to end it on such a bummer.
Yeah.
Because, spoiler,
She died of cancer
in her 40s.
Yeah.
And if that final bit feels rushed. And I understand, I appreciate the idea, I appreciate the need, the desire to not be maudlin.
Yeah.
And this film is not maudlin.
No,
about her at all. But I believe that by not giving it a little more room,
yeah,
and just sort of ending it coldly like that,
mm-hmm.
You know, you go into this documentary, if you know who she is and you loved her, you go into a documentary like this thinking, give me that emotional bump at the end, please. Right. So that I can walk away from this and feel like I've had my moment of grief, you know, as a fan. And that's kind of partially what films like this are for.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds weird, but that is true, I think.
And there's no shame in that game. It's also, this movie, I think, is kind of a reminder that the movies never figured out what to do with her.
No. Sure, all the movies she was in were pretty terrible.
Yeah. I mean, it was a small handful, but like, yeah, they just never...
Not counting the one they shot of her one-woman stage.
Guild Alive, yeah. Show. Which, even that one, I've heard people say, like, as a concert film doesn't quite do her justice. I've still never seen it, so I need to watch it and find out. But yeah, like, you know, she met Gene Wilder on Hanky Panky, a movie you didn't even know had existed.
I didn't know that film existed, yeah.
You know, then they made The Woman in Red together, which is pretty terrible. And then they made Haunted Honeymoon, which I've never seen, but is considered...
Sort of legendarily bad, right?
Well, I mean, like, I'm sure Louis Vertel would tell you that it's great. It has its...
Oh, is it?
I think it has its champions among people who saw it when they were eight.
Listen,
you know?
I'll listen to Louis if he's got something to say about it. Yeah, I trust
him. But I've never seen it, so I couldn't say.
I'm curious about some of the omissions.
It's weird that, like, Jane Curtin didn't speak to them, but Lorraine Newman did.
Right.
That seemed like,
There was no Garrett Morris.
No, nor Lorne Michaels, was there? I think there was just, like...
Well, there was...
archival footage of him, but...
I don't know if he was new or not. But no current Aykroyd, no current Bill Murray.
No.
Those are all archival additions. I think the stories... I'm curious about the stories I've heard about Belushi being such a dick to her.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if those stories are... how grounded they are in reality, if they are, you know, just someone's...
apocryphal.
Yeah, I don't know, because I haven't done the research into this. Mm. But, you know, you hear things.
Sure.
You're like, oh, he was terrible to all the women on that show.
Hmm.
You know, who knows? Yeah. But that's, according to this film, he was like her brother.
Yeah.
It's stuff like that.
Sure.
You know, I wish we'd had a little more Gene Wilder. In terms of...
his presence in her life?
His presence in her life. I do know that I read something somewhere that Bill Murray in particular was unhappy about how she just disappeared from their lives.
Well, they mention in the movie that once she settled in L.A. with Gene Wilder, that she pretty much like cut off all of her old SNL friends.
Yeah. And we didn't... they didn't go into that.
I'm glad they talked to Alan.
Why that happened? What that was about?
I'm glad they talked to Alan Zweibel because I know they worked together very closely, and he wrote a book about her called Bunny Bunny.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, it does a lot of things right, and it's certainly if you are too young to have seen much Gilda Radner or know who she was or why she mattered, you know, this is a good primer.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's okay.
Then we watched Little Women.
Ooh, boy.
First of all, can we just stop with all the Little Women?
Too late. Greta Gerwig's already on the case.
How many Little Women's do we need?
Well,
we've got a few really good ones.
Yeah.
The Katharine Hepburn one.
Uh-huh.
The Elizabeth Taylor one.
Yeah.
The Gillian Armstrong one.
With Winona Ryder, yeah.
Three good, solid Little Women adaptations.
Absolutely. It's public.
There was one for British television, I think, or
last year
Masterpiece here on PBS.
Yes, with
I heard it wasn't very good.
That was one person told us that. I've heard other people who liked it. Okay. I need to watch it. It was Emily Watson and Emily Watson.
I do not know.
And Angela Lansbury as Aunt March.
Okay.
Who,
for the record, can go to the
Dickens.
Go to the Dickens.
there was a 70s
I'll never not find that hilarious.
It's a Katharine Hepburn line from the 30s version of the George Cukor one. There was a 70s TV movie version with Eve Plum.
What?
Yeah, I believe as Beth.
What?
Yes.
Where
yes.
is that?
It's out there somewhere.
Okay, I'll watch that one.
Might be on YouTube. There was one made for TV in 2012 called The March Sisters at Christmas Time that is set in the modern day, which is what this new one does. And the new one very cleverly says it's the first theatrical version to be set in the modern day.
I see.
So it's to discount the TV one. There's a lot about this movie that I like on paper. It is the 150th anniversary of the novel. So, you know, timing wise, I get it. It is written, directed, edited, and shot by women.
Yes.
Which is really progressive, especially given that this was made by a faith-based company.
Or at least distributed by
No,
them.
Both. It was produced by a company It was produced by a company called Pinnacle Peak, I believe.
Okay.
Which I think is redundant, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, it is.
And then PureFlix is releasing it. And it's certainly leagues better than most PureFlix flicks.
No. I will go so far as to say it is the very best PureFlix film that has ever been made.
Okay, fair enough.
And it's still terrible.
It's still terrible. Is it terrible?
It's
or is
terrible.
It just okay?
It's
yeah.
terrible.
It
looks like garbage.
Yeah, it is. It is filmed
cheap and too bright,
yeah.
And the performances are also terrible.
Yeah, I especially want to point out this movie's Jo. I'm looking up her name for her own shame. Sarah Davenport is this young lady's
name.
Where has
she been before?
Her credits include a TV show called Stitchers that I do not know. And something called Body Snatch.
All right.
A lot of things I have no idea what they are.
Okay.
She is pitched so high and so frantically energetic.
Yeah.
In every
scene. No, like, matter if it calls for it or not.
She plays every scene like the most caffeinated Lorelai Gilmore imaginable. And it's like, you want her to just, okay, you're giving me an 11, give me a 6.
Yep.
So that's, a little of her goes a very long way.
I every 10 minutes, I just thought to myself, why so much yelling? Why are we yelling so much?
Yeah. It's all rather overbearing, and a lot of the plot points that it hits from the book feel kind of wedged in, and then other times you have, like Laurie's grandfather is never mean, so it's not a big deal when he becomes nice.
Right.
Aunt March is never particularly mean either, so,
right.
Like...
So why would you tell her to go to the Dickens?
No one does, yeah. But, you know, it just feels like, well, then why are you even here? And then Christy and I had the complicated conversation about... Do we ever buy Lucas Grabeel as a heterosexual?
No.
Yeah.
And yes, gay actors should play straight parts.
Absolutely.
Unless you're real gay.
Well, no, I think then you have to act more or better or something. Like,
and I don't even know if Lucas Grabeel is officially gay or not.
I don't know
if he's officially
I don't know if he's done the paperwork, but,
yeah,
you know.
But, girl, come on. Listen, from one gay to another gay to all the gays in all the world, we see you.
Mm-hmm.
We are your gay brothers. We see who you are. We know where you are. We approve of you playing heterosexual roles if you are a gay actor. Unless you're real gay.
And
then you got to either do better,
yeah,
or just be like, you know what, I'll just play gay parts.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, look, we, you know, he's younger than we are, so I don't know.
Has Andrew Rannells ever played a heterosexual person? Book of Mormon, I guess.
Book
maybe.
Of Mormon, but that's in a but Broadway show,
a Broadway musical,
and he played a Mormon missionary,
right?
So you know, yeah.
But look how he leans into everything about himself.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. Do not hide your light under a bushel, Lucas Grabeel. Don't get us wrong.
No.
But, like, you got to bring a little something to these roles if you're supposed to play Butch.
I don't know if Butch is the right word to use, but I just... He is miscast.
He is miscast as Laurie.
Because I look at him and I'm like, what's up, High School Musical, in the pink hat.
Yeah.
Dancing with the Sharpay and the little doggies. And
also a really good baseball player, let's not forget. We learned
also
that
a super great baseball player the High School Musical films. Yes. I had high hopes for him, A, publicly coming out, and B, being in films where he got to be, you know, that guy.
Yes.
Now he's in Little Women.
Yeah.
As someone who wants to marry a little woman.
Yes.
I don't get it.
You have gifts, Lucas Brabeel. Lean into them.
Yes.
What else?
Is that the end of our discussion of Little Women?
I think pretty
that
much.
That no one should see.
Yeah, do not bother.
Do not see this version.
Because you're going to have to see the Greta Gerwig one in a year.
If you've Catherine Hepburn, George Cukor version, you're in for a treat.
I'm going to say if you're going to see one, see the Gillian Armstrong.
It's the Gillian Armstrong one, yeah. Because when Claire Danes cries.
Oh, my God. That was where the Claire Danes ugly cry, I think, was really born. I mean, she did it on My So-Called Life.
She did it on My So-Called Life.
But, man, does it connect in Little Women.
It was the, yeah. Everything she would become on Homeland, you saw emerging in that Little Women.
Oh, God.
I love that movie.
So good.
It's probably my favorite version of Little Women.
Oh, no question.
Until Catherine Hepburn opens her mouth and says literally anything in that film.
I'm going to be a great writer.
The Sisters Brothers.
Yes.
Go.
I'm so excited. No, I've been talking this whole episode. You talk about the Sisters Brothers.
Okay, so two brothers. Their last name is Sisters.
Yes.
Eli and Charlie. Eli is John C. Reilly.
Right.
Charlie is Joaquin Phoenix.
Right.
They are 19th century Wild West hitmen.
Yes.
They are employed by Rutger Hauer, who is named the Commodore.
Yes.
They have to go find a chemist.
Well, we don't know at first that's what he is. They just said that they had to find Riz Ahmed, who took a thing.
Yeah. Riz Ahmed took something from the Commodore. But the thing he took from the Commodore, because he is a chemist, is an incredibly toxic liquid that you can dump in a river and it makes the gold glow. So you can just reach in and get that gold. Jake Gyllenhaal is another person on his trail and who sort of kidnaps him.
Well, he sort of like also works for the Commodore, but he's kind of an advanced man who gets closer to him.
Now, oh, by the way, the chemist's name, Riz Ahmed's name, is Herman Kermit Worm.
Oh, right.
That is such a good name. And then all four of these people, their paths cross. And a series of unfortunate events play out. That's all I really want to tell you, because, quite frankly,
this movie isn't so much about the plot.
The plot is absolutely secondary to what's going on between these guys.
Yeah.
All four of them.
The relationship between the brothers, the relationship between the brothers and the other two dudes, the friendship between the two dudes.
There are enough Western genre elements to keep you satisfied and to keep you on board with the idea that, yes, this is a Western.
Yeah.
It is also not condescending to the genre.
Right.
It's taking you in a weird direction. In fact, it's taking you in several weird directions and several weird tones that shift and move in unexpected ways. But it is never winking at you.
No.
As a Western. It's never saying, well, we said it in the Wild Wild West, but, you know, we're really being very contemporary here.
No, and I think that we forget that the Western is a very malleable genre.
Yeah.
You can do all kinds of things in it. You can do comedy. You can do Shakespeare, you can do political allegory,
yeah,
you can do art film, whatever you want.
And there's a little bit of all of those things going on in this film. Did we say who made it?
It's directed by Jacques Audiard, who is the French filmmaker behind Rust and Bone and A Prophet. And Deepan.
Yeah.
This is his first English language movie. It definitely has that European in America.
Oh.
Look at all that sky. Look at these trees.
Yeah, yeah. He's clearly in love with the filmmaking process.
Yeah.
In this work. And also, he's watched a lot of Westerns.
Sure.
He knows where he's going. He knows what he wants to do. And he knows what he wants to screw around with, too.
Yes.
Here's what I think I loved the most about this really cool movie. I have to let me state unequivocally that this very weird movie is really awesome.
Yeah, this was one of the best things I saw at Venice this year.
I think kind of what this film boils down to, for me at least, is what do you do with your brother that you need, but who makes you want to kill him?
That is definitely a part of it.
There is so much ugly and contemporary and heartbreaking family drama happening here.
Yeah.
Well, you want to just dislike both of them because, you know, they're killers.
Yeah.
You come to realize that regardless of what they do for a living, the thing that's got them maybe doomed in life is the way they are just sort of inextricably linked.
Their codependent relationship.
Yeah.
Well, because the brother played by Joaquin Phoenix is an alcoholic. He clearly is happy to be in this life where they are constantly on the move, constantly wandering around and killing people. Whereas John C. Reilly clearly wants to settle down. He wants stability. He wants romance.
He wants a home. He wants to open a store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the push and pull between the two of them and how that all resolves itself is really interesting. What the movie has to say about what men inevitably do to an unspoiled environment.
What greed does to people and does to the world that they live in.
Yeah. That's in there. The whole notion about, the Riz Ahmed character is less, wants to find gold mainly so that he can found a utopian commune.
Yeah.
In Dallas. And even the relationship with the brothers, it touches on a thing that you see in a lot of Westerns, which is the kind of tug of war between the wildness of the West and the encroachment of civilization.
Right.
The Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, for instance.
I love John C. Reilly in this.
This is one of his best roles ever. He's so great in this.
I agree. He's all over the place.
Yeah.
But it feels coherent.
Yes. He gets to play with all the colors in his paint box.
And you wind up caring exactly about what he cares about?
Yes.
You want everything to work out for him, at least.
Have you seen the trailer for Holmes and Watson?
No, I don't even know what that is.
Will Ferrell is Sherlock Holmes, and John C. Reilly is Dr. Watson.
Oh, my God. When is this coming out? I love Step Brothers so much.
It's coming out at Christmas. The trailer is not promising. I did not laugh once. The trailer was as much of a lead balloon for me as Night School was.
How can it be?
It looks like The Naked Gun, frankly, which is not the worst thing, I suppose. But I don't know. It seems kind of labored to me. Oh, and as I'm looking, it's from the director of Get Hard. So anyway, we'll see what this is like.
I'm not happy anymore.
But
I just want to be happy.
the trailer was not promising, but you never know. You never know.
You're right.
I hope if nothing else,
one does never know.
I hope it doesn't actively deter from what I imagine will be John C. Reilly's award season victory lap for this movie, because he's really great in it.
I agree. Yeah. If you think you don't like Westerns.
Oh, absolutely.
You probably don't, but you should see this.
Yeah.
It's the best thing. It came out, what, last week?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's expanding this week. Yeah.
Okay. I got a DVD pick.
What's that?
Olivier Assayas's Cold Water.
Ah, yeah.
Now it's on Criterion, the Criterion Collection. Just put it out this week.
I missed its theatrical reissue, so I'm totally going to watch it.
It's so incredible.
Cool.
About rootless teens.
Okay.
In the early 1970s.
Mm.
And
in France.
In France, and they're sort of, you know, ennui and self-destruction.
So I like my listless French teens.
No, it's truly mesmerizing. Okay. And I happily got to see it in its theatrical run earlier this year. Because it had never been released in the United States.
Right. And it's like a new 2K or something restoration.
2K, 4K, I don't know how many Ks. Mm. Some Ks.
All the Ks.
And Now you get to watch it, and it's, if you like Olivier Assayas' films, even if you don't, maybe you'll like this one. I love it. I'm
Olivier Assayas is one of those filmmakers I think that you could like a section of his filmography.
Yeah,
because it runs a pretty wide gamut.
It really does.
Like, you can love Irma Vep and not Summer Hours, and vice versa. You know.
I suppose you're right about that. But I love both of them.
No, me too. But like, you know, this is the guy who made Demon Lover.
And Boarding Gate.
Yeah.
Also films I love.
So it's, you know.
He's never steered me wrong, honestly.
There are.
I'm down for him pretty much always.
There are people who love his entire filmography, but I'm saying there's probably also people who like parts of it, you know. Like, you know, I saw Nonfiction this year, and it's definitely closer to Summer Hours than it is to Boarding Gate, you know.
Right. Where'd you see that, Venice?
Uh-huh.
When's it coming out?
I think before the end of the year.
Before the end of the year.
Yeah, it's really good.
You want to do some letters?
Oh, yeah. Why don't I send you some? Hang on. We had several letters about our Mandy conversation from last week.
But here's the one we're going to read because it's long. And
from friend of the show and former one-time guest.
Mark Hoick. But before I read this letter, I need to tell you something. We have a Patreon. And that Patreon is on patreon.com/linoleumknife. If you go there, you'll learn all about the other podcasts that we do for people who subscribe. And if you want to subscribe, you should do it. And if you don't want to subscribe, then don't. That's all.
You can enjoy this for free.
Oh, and if you're already a subscriber, I want you to go to Patreon and look at all the prizes and then email me at dlelandwhite1964 and tell me which one you want.
@gmail.com.
If you are at a level that gets a prize. Don't be all like, I've subscribed for $7 a month. Where's my prize? Well, no, you get a sticker. And please do that. dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. Tell me what you want, and it's coming to you. What else should they know? Don't ask for a tote bag. They're gone.
Oh, well. They were too beautiful to live.
Yeah.
But yeah, our Patreon, we do fun stuff, and we have fun items, and you should consider joining. That
now
is
the letter.
Where are my glasses?
Oh, good Lord. I don't know.
Granddad needs us.
Cheaters.
His readers.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
First, I'm chopping the introduction because there's no need. Anyway, first, addressing your trenchant, spoiler-ridden vivisection of life itself, which of course led to the wonderful listener tweet, get yourself a man who is willing to punch your leg during screenings of Crash.
Thank you, Nayland.
I want to say that as one of the last 11 people in the world who still find some value in that film, that has given up making a case for it because I know when I'm licked, but more importantly, having been witness to your affectionate repartee for a decade and a half now, I heartily approve that message. But in all seriousness, as you described its plot, full of shock, plot turns, and ludicrous happenstance, I became reminded of one of my favorite films of all time, Claude Lelouch's And Now My Love, which, by binary measurement, engages in the same structure. I'm not sure if either of you have seen it, but knowing Alonzo shares my fondness for Lelouch's ambitious reworking of Les Miserables, I'm gambling you'll at least be familiar with it.
I adore his Les Miserables, and I wish it were on DVD.
Neither of us have seen And Now My Love.
Yeah, I know the title, but I've never seen it.
Obviously, And Now My Love has much better critical reputation, but it occurred to me that stories with Rube Goldbergian contrivance, such as that, or more recently, Amelie, are more welcomed when they are in French than when they are attempted in English. Yes, Sleepless in Seattle was a hit, but more often, you get films like The Completely Forgotten, Till There Was You with Gene Triplehorn, which I've never seen, but reading up on it also has a similar conceit of let's take the couple that will be together at the end and keep almost putting them together, but keep them apart until they've had enough life experience that they're ready for each other. I suppose it can be argued Lelouch's film holds up because it's not just about the cheap conceit of missed encounters and coincidence, but also about their generational history and politics and culture and how that shapes them into becoming right for each other. Whereas, Life itself sounds like Fogelman just drew the lines of connection like one of those darned every shared member of your favorite rock band flowcharts you used to see in head shops without considering how to make the circumstance compelling. Would you add any more thoughts to this? No.
We would if we'd seen the Lelouch movie.
You have added all the thoughts.
Yeah.
And I thank you for adding all of those thoughts.
We got nothing.
As for Mandy. Okay, so y'all. Mark Hoyk is about to blow my mind, because I've read this letter already, and I had not considered this. If you have not seen Mandy, just shut the podcast off.
We'll say goodbye now.
The only thing we're going to do after we read this letter is say goodbye. So if you haven't seen Mandy, and we've told you some things about it, but we didn't tell you everything. There's a thing that happens at the end, and I mean the end. I mean the bitter end. I mean the post-credits end.
Which I did not know about, and so I didn't even see.
Because I saw it and just thought, oh, that's nice. But he saw it and came up with something.
I was so annoyed by the movie that once those credits started, I was out.
You were out. Okay. So here we go. He's going to tell you about the very, very, very last seconds of Mandy and what he thinks they mean. As for Mandy, I suppose this may be a spoiler because this element was placed at the end as a post-credits cookie. But since for me, it reshaped how I read the entire film, I think it's worth bringing up, since I've yet to find anyone else contemplating it. And while it won't likely change Alonzo's general boredom of the story, it may reshape some of Dave's issues with it. At the beginning of the movie, it is established that Andrea Riseborough is an aspiring artist, with Cage coming home to her and admiring her drawings. It also shows her working as a cashier at a convenience store while he cuts trees. I suspect that since she is reading a lurid fantasy paperback during that moment, she's likely been inspired to draw by the covers of those books, along with the metal music that she loves, but it's just a hobby. Spoiler. After all the credits are done, we see her drawing table, which has sketches of many of the story's elements. A bloodied cage, a tiger, the super sword, etc. In effect, to me this suggests that all of the violent action that has taken place is a fantasy she has imagined as a demonstration of how much she knows that she is loved by her man. A sidebar. When Tarantino first came on the scene, profiles of him talked about how, for years as a child, he would invent wild, violent adventure stories involving his young mother, where most times she died in some valiant, noble fashion, that when she objected to being bumped off, he would tell her, yeah, but it made me sad and I cried about it. Later, of course, we got Kill Bill, which is a big-budget version of that template, with its themes of broken homes, bad fathers, lost friendships, and mashing up of various genres. It is effectively a bedtime story, told by a child to his mother, where he says, my mom loves me so much that if I got taken away, she would beat the crap out of anyone and everyone and defy death to find me. The Triplets of Belleville has a similar woman engaged in stern coaching, has a similar structure, while at the beginning it starts with elderly grandmère ostensibly finishing a story to her grandson, as the wild adventure unfolds with the old woman engaged in stern coaching of her grandson in cycling and meeting her favorite singing trio of her youth while coming to his rescue. It finishes with her in bed and the grandson reading to her, suggesting that he has concocted this story to elevate her frail spirits. Thus, what seems initially like Riseborough being initially inactive and fridged in the course of the story, to me, now plays to me as her creating the scenario which will put her lover into the role of avenging hero. Her tentative demeanor in the domestic scenes beforehand suggests that, much as you described, she is one of those polite but shy women at the convention whose demeanor belies her tastes. The 1983 setting, which puts the story long before things like Riot Girls, women being embraced in the fantasy community beyond arm candy, or female musicians getting their due, suggests she's an early adopter who left suburbia because she already knows she doesn't fit in. I think it's also telling that while they both seem to like the same stuff, she's the only one seen in band shirts, and while she has her art, Cage doesn't have any outside creative activity. He's just sort of a strong, simple grunt, so she's the fantasist in that relationship. Consider who the villain is. A man who thinks he's smart and complex but is ultimately not just a never-was rock star, but in the genre she hates the most, folk. Speaking of which, were either of you thinking of that classic Bill Hicks joke about how David Koresh was a failed musician who surrounded himself with sycophants and thought he was God? Sounds like every one of my friends in Austin. I'm waiting for Will Sexton to build a compound somewhere.
I didn't know that one.
And there's the fact that we see Linus Roach's full Monty in that sequence, and the way that she almost sounds like she's going to compliment his musicianship and manhood, but then laughs at him before getting offed. I suggest that's kind of male-gazy, but I sense that if this were a full-on boys' fantasy, they wouldn't bother with showing full nudity or teasing flattery. But then the big question of why she would kill herself off in her own story. Her behavior suggests that she does not have the best image of herself, whereas she idealizes her mate. It's worth noting the prominent facial scar that she's always present with. The prominent facial scar that is always present even in the ending flashback to when she and Cage first met. She likely has self-image issues, and Cage is the man who has transcended them. So he is already mythic in her eyes, and she doesn't see herself as her own hero. But as a lover of black metal and fantasy books, she knows somebody important has to die to spur the dramatic revenge. As Bugs Bunny would say, what did you expect from a black metal opera? A happy ending? So to me, I think what Mandy is really about is a creative woman who has a good, if basic, man in her life, and one night after some music, beer, and weed, conjured up how to make him a paperback hero. I kind of love this idea that she's the driving force of the story, and that it's all her fantasy.
As fan theories go, it's a good one, and it's cohesive. I still hate this movie.
I'm sorry, Alonzo, but you're incorrect.
Whatever, I know. Look, I'm going to be hearing for the next several years, oh my God, that is amazing.
And that's exactly how we're going to say it, too.
Yeah. That's what all Twitter is right now. Film Twitter.
Well, that's all
like,
Twitter is.
Oh, God, man. Anyway.
We're done.
All right. Thank you all for listening. Go check out our friends on the internet. First of all, thank you, Blue, as always, for our theme music. It's great. Blutopia.com, BLEUTOPIA, to find out what he's up to. Also, go to ChristyLemire.com for all of her stuff, including the current version of What the Flick. Check out Bibbs and Whitney on their podcasts, Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed over the Schmoes Know Network. And, of course, check out the Schmoes Know. Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the All Things Cozy podcast, the Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Secretly Timid. You can subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us that 5-star review there. We do appreciate them. They help a lot. You can also leave positive feedback in all the places where we stream. Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean, etc. You can follow us at LinoleumCast, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And patreon.com/linoleumknife. Right. Get stuff.
That's it.
So until next time.
Goodbye.